Accession number 14978, Charles Turnbull, reel 10.
Mr. Turnbull, reel 10. You were talking about your duty as sergeant on the boat, Mr. Turnbull. Was it the sergeant's, NCO's duty to keep an eye on the men rather than the officers on the ship itself?
Yes, it was. You had your duty of looking after the men and seeing that they were all right in the quarters that had been allocated. I can't remember being in any specific duties for the men. We hadn't anticipated a long journey or anything like that. It was just a case of trying to ensure that the men were as comfortable as possible and were fed, received the meals, what could be eaten, if anyone felt like eating them, and ensuring that the quarters were kept clean as far as possible, and if it was possible, getting them up onto the deck to see that they had fresh air. And
was it pretty crowded?
Yes, it was fairly congested. I would say, can't remember it being over congested, but the boat was carrying as many as were possibly could, as far as I can remember. We just had everybody was aboard the one boat.
That would be your whole battalion, because I believe you went in ahead of the head of the brigade.
That's right. The 10th battalion were the first battalion to go. There had been an advance party sent out, I think the back end of the August, because one had to remember that really this was really an initial occupation of Iceland. So an advance party had to be sent to find out what the position exactly was on the rest of the unit landing there.
What was the attitude of the men now that they'd been told on the boat they were going to Iceland? How did they receive it?
At the time, a little nonplussed, because one hadn't had any indication at all where you were likely to go. And the great problem really had been, when we'd gone up to Scotland, everybody thought it would be somewhere out east. And when they weren't issued with tropical clothing, to find out that you're going to Iceland, and the word Iceland, everyone thought, well, the conditions as far as cold would be very, very severe. And one didn't really know what to expect. And then, of course, the information was given off what we were going to do when we got there. That really it was to forestall any attempted landings by a German force, with the North Atlantic traffic routes being so vulnerable. So that after the information had given, one then could understand the reason why you were going.
Whereabouts from Scotland did you sail?
I think we sailed from Rothsay.
And whilst on your journey, did they give you any talks or lectures on what to expect in Iceland and what the population might be like or how they would receive you?
Not really. I don't think anyone really knew. It had something that had been thrust upon them, and the 49th Division had been the one that had been elected to go there. It was a case of finding out and making the best of things when you got there.
You've been promoted to sergeant. What were your duties now, in the general sense?
Well, now After the lieutenant commanding the platoon.
Was it the same lieutenant, same platoon, or had you moved?
Same platoon, I think. Can't remember it being any different.
Still in D Company.
Still in D Company. And we had the platoon commander, who at that time, I think it was Brutnell. And you knew then that you were his right-hand man, and you had to ensure that his orders were carried out, and the object being that your platoon would be the best in the company. And the sergeant had to ensure that really the discipline was good, his men were cared for and looked after, and really without any hesitation, the duties that you had to carry out were done out creditably and well.
So your duties were general across the whole platoon now?
That was it. You were looked upon as, after the lieutenant commanding the company, I would say that you were a person who was looked up to. And I would say that really your training from private upwards had probably been of a different nature to a sergeant in the regular army. That I don't think that really probably you had the harsh sort of discipline of a sergeant in the regular army. You'd been trained in a different fashion. The drill wasn't the be-all and the end-all of everything. There was other important factors in the modern army that there had been, which was different to the peacetime army. A sergeant in the regular army, in my idea, had a different aspect to the situation altogether to what the new recruit had who'd come into the forces, that he'd been trained in a different fashion. I think that really, probably you had a more modern thought to what warfare could be like compared to the, should we say, the 1914-19 idea of what combat was like, which I think the old regular type of soldier still had in his mind, that it would still be probably a static war. And after the experiences in France, one knew that this was a different war and you had to be trained differently. And I think with the initial reaction in France, that the NCO, with his little knowledge, tried to import that upon the soldier that he was now dealing with, who had received no initial training in that type of warfare or conditions that had existed in France.
I was saying, in effect, that the regular sergeant, regular NCO, was more regimentally, narrowly regimentally
trained. I would say that was my reaction. Not that I had anything against them. I mean, you still met chaps who you respected, and you respected his ideas. But I think with the men, the recruits who were coming in, the modern thought was appreciated more, that the old type of soldiering had gone out and one had to be trained in the future in that aspect of the situation.
The approach and discipline must have been different. After all, you were in effect civilians, just forced into the situation as against a man who had chosen his career professionally. So the approaches would be different anyway, and of course your experience and background would be different, wider. Would you say that?
I would say yes. But one still did realize that discipline must be maintained and orders must be carried out. But one had different methods of ensuring that that was maintained. My reaction was, and I've said previously, that when parades commenced, one knew that you had to instill upon your platoon at that time that your orders and what you said must be carried out. But at the end of the day, at the end of parades or whatever had transpired during the day, off-duty hours had to be of a different nature, that I soon found out that if you talked and played with the men and participated, that was a means of getting greater respect than probably what the pre-war soldier had. I think the idea then was that he was the sergeant or the sergeant major, and he was a person to be feared rather than respected.
Did you feel that the civilian recruit expected more explanation rather than direct order, you will do that?
I would say so, that really the wartime soldier, could we say that really his education had probably been a little better, and with working in his civilian job, he knew at that time that really when you worked for somebody else, that if you were working for somebody else, your job had to be done correctly, otherwise you were out of a job. And he respected his owners or the employer who'd employed him, and I think that that had really been carried on into his army days, that when he came across somebody who was higher up the ladder than him, if he knew that that person had that little bit of something whereby he had been able to gain promotion, that he should be respected. And he soon found out what type of an individual that person was. And if the NCO gained his respect without any quibble, he would carry out the duties that had been allocated to him. It doesn't matter whether it was guard duty or whether it was duties peeling spuds or helping cooks or anything like that, or latrine duties. If that he'd been allocated to that duty in his turn and he had fair treatment, he would do it.
Now you're a sergeant, your pay would obviously increase.
Yes.
Did you recall how much it was as a sergeant?
Never had any thoughts about that, because all that happened was you'd made an, of course I was married then, and I'd made an allocation. And what one received was sufficient to get by on. But really what happened, naturally, your wife was living in England, and my wife at that time was working in Blackpool, and what she did was, she was the type of person who, as thoughts were, on when she would see me again and when we could resume married life, and that the allocation that she received from me was put straight into the post office, trying to think that in the future, when we resumed our married life, that we would get some sort of a kick-off after the war ended.
How much was the allocation?
I can't remember the figure.
You originally, before marriage, had made an allocation to your parents.
That's right.
Now, did that cease when you got married?
That went to my wife.
Where did you land in Iceland?
Reykjavik.
Do you recall the date?
I think it would be in the first 2 weeks, probably about the 12th, 11th, something like that.
What month?
Beginning September.
What was your initial reaction to of arriving, when you did arrive in Iceland? What was your initial
reaction? Well, we wondered what it would all be about and what would really happen. We hadn't been told a great deal. I don't think even the battalion commander had great ideas of what the setup would initially be. And I can remember that we first of all went into, after landing, after going away from the dockside, we went to a transit camp. And then after a few days, I think only after about 5 or 6 days, the order came that you be allocated posts on various parts of the island. And D Company and Headquarter Company were sent to Borgarnes. I can remember how that was spelled, if you can't remember. B-O-R-G-A-N-E-S. And other parts of the battalion were sent to outposts, defence posts, some larger than others. The furthest north, I think, was a place called, I used to say, Akureyri. And the name slipped my mind at the moment, but as I've said, there was small outposts, defence posts, and it was a larger one in Akureyri, and therefore the battalion was now split up. But Headquarter Company was in Borgarnes, which was the control point. Borgarnes was quite a fair way from Reykjavik. Akureyri was further north. But I can remember that getting to Borgarnes by road was quite difficult. And when the weather was adverse, quite a hazardous journey. So that really, most of the supplies and equipment and that sort of thing that was necessary was shipped from Reykjavik to Borgarnes, which I think was approximately about 30 miles plus.
Had you brought your own transport with you? With the British Army lorries?
It was British Army vehicle. I can't remember whether they were brought by the battalion or not, or whether this had been allocated when we got there. Because all that had been there before, it probably would be. Because all that had been there before we were there, I think a few Marines had been there earlier than what we were there, and there were some Canadians, but before we landed there hadn't been a great deal of troops there, which I think was really probably why the reaction of the Icelandic people initially, it wasn't very favourable.
In what way?
Well, I think they still thought that really the Germans were superior to the British forces, and they still had the idea that Germany would win the war, and that really probably there would be an attempted landing in Iceland. And I think after what had happened in Europe, they really thought that the Germans were a superior force and we would be pushed out. That really, I think it was a case more of fear. And they didn't really want to become too friendly in case this happened. I would say that really that was my reaction. that one found out that if you went into the few days we were in Reykjavik, if you went to a cafe, really, they weren't very happy about serving you at all. And of course, it took a long, long time before this was really overcome. I would think that when we went to Borgarnes, I think when the troops there mixed amongst the population, after a period, it recovered a little quicker than what it did in Reykjavik, with Reykjavik being the capital.
Did that lead to problems in those early days between civilians and troops? Who, for example, you say...
No, it didn't lead to problems, just we weren't very happy with the reception. But there wasn't any trouble. I think that really, the training that you had at that time, when you went out in your off-duty times, the little that you had, it was important, really, that you attempted to ensure that relations between the Icelandic people and yourselves became better. And there again, our youth came into it again. We had been taught to respect our elders and not cause trouble. And I think that initial training as a young man came into it.
Do you feel that one of the thoughts that they may have had was that in effect you were an occupying power, you were foreigners?
Well, we were. And one had to remember that really Iceland had never been occupied before. And let's face it, I think we would be the same. I mean, if we'd had the Germans occupying England, what would we have felt like? No doubt, the Germans were the enemy. The difference probably was that we weren't the enemies of the Icelandic people. We were there to do a job. But, as I've said initially, I think it was the fear that after what had happened in the European countries, they really thought in the background that nothing would stop the Germans. And I think that was the real fear, that the Germans would come there, and if they were too favourable towards the British or any other nation, that would react on them. I think really, when it really commenced to change, was when we started to get visits from the one in particular was when Churchill came to Iceland.
Do you recall when that was?
I think it would be probably about the following September.
A year after you got there?
After we got there.
And in what way did this improve things, do you feel?
Well, he was quite a figure, wasn't he? It when the troops paraded and had to be inspected by him, he was such a powerful figure and well known, well, throughout, should we say, the world, really, for his leadership and the speeches that he'd made. His back to the wall attitude and how everybody responded to what he had to say. And I think that had been transmitted to the local population. And when they saw him there with his cigar and his and how he was dressed and his stick and all this sort of thing, that really he was a figure, a national figure, and so well known that I think in the end the feeling crept in that in the end the British forces would win the battle. That I think that attitude started to creep in, and as the British troops that were there, how they had performed, and there hadn't been anything should we say, atrocious done to the population. They've been well behaved, and I think that sort of thing had gained their respect, that the feeling before we came away had changed.
Did you get any other quite famous figures visiting you? Well-known figures?
That's the one that lived in my memory more than anybody else. I think we did have other figures who did come, but Churchill was the one who was looked forward to most of all.
Did you get to speak to him at all?
No, but you saw him quite close when he inspected the regiment. Quite a cold day. Snow on the ground, ice.
The headquarters that you, situation that you were in, that you moved to first of all, what was the terrain of the island like?
Well, the terrain, it was very barren. No vegetation or trees. Rugged. The mountains always snow-capped. Quite impressive. And of course around Reykjavik you had the hot springs. I think in the winter the daylight that you had was only about 4 or 5 hours, and in the winter of course the conditions were severe. In the camp it was often snowed up, but once one came out of there, that time we were living in Nissen huts, it was an easy matter to get lost in the area of the camp. If one came out, it was difficult to find where your Nissen hut was, and there was occasions when men had to be found that had gone out and had lost the way.
Can you describe the camp? You mentioned Nissen huts.
Yes, it was. We were in when we landed in Borgarnes, there had been Marines there before, but it wasn't a complete Nissen hutted camp. They were still really in the course of construction, and initially, one had to make the best of things. That really you had to remember, as I've said, no trees. The timber had to be imported, and it wasn't an easy matter to gain all the supplies that you wanted. Everything had to come by boat. That really in the winter the road was often impassable, and it was quite a long journey by road, even if lorries could come along the road. That it was a case of making the best of the job that you could. And anybody who had any knowledge of carpentry or that sort of thing was installed in the job to make things as comfortable as possible. I can remember on what timber was available, chairs being constructed, and army blankets used as padding, I think, and stuffed with sawdust and things like that, you know, and really make the place look like home as far as possible, where the troops cut pictures out of books and things like that and pin them up on the walls, and it was a case of making the living conditions as best as what one possibly could, which in the end one could say, well, pretty fair, apart from having to contend with the weather.
Nissen huts are notoriously cold.
Cold.
Was there any way that you could insulate against that cold?
Not insulation. We had the stoves. I think there was two per Nissen hut.
How many men would be held in a Nissen hut?
Can't remember the exact number, but quite a number.
And you had two stoves.
Mm-hmm.
And what were they fired with?
Can't remember exactly.
Not but likely to be timber, because there wasn't any.
Well, timber wouldn't be used. But the stoves were lit. But what fuel was used, my memory doesn't carry us back that far.
What were the men sleeping on?
They had, we had, like a bed. Oh, yes.
And the usual kit inspections, did they go on in the usual way?
Well, kit inspections were carried out because you had to ensure that the kit was up to date and was looked after. Because one had to remember, really, at that time when everything, all supplies, had to be carried out by boat, really. Which meant that, really, I think there was a lot of thieving going on with such as naffy supplies and any form of clothing or equipment. It had to be closely looked after.